Welcome to Paradigm Shifters, and we have a paradigm shifter who's really shifting paradigms today. Charles Eisenstein is talking about sacred economy, and I think it's a very, very, very exciting subject these days. Charles, how did you get into doing all that, or how did you get into thinking about it that way?
Well, I don't know if you've noticed, but in our society, the topic of money is pretty much unavoidable.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's like the lifeblood of our anxiety a lot of times, isn't
mm-hmm.
it?
Uh-huh. Right. And when you look at the world and the bad things that are happening, and you ask, why is this happening? At least when I ask it, it doesn't take long for money to come up. Mm-hmm. You know, somebody's making money off it. You know, why are we sending so many people to prison? Why are we cutting down the forests? You know, why are we fracking? Anything terrible going on.
And why are they drilling for oil down where the Gulf was so terribly torn up? Yeah.
Mm. Yeah. So the question then comes up, well, okay, why is money this bad thing?
Mm-hmm.
Is it because it's the essence of materiality and, you know, materiality is bad and we need to escape it and go into the realm of spirit? Or is that part of the problem? And maybe the solution is to change our relationship to this material world. And perhaps money could be something different than it has been.
Because money itself isn't bad, is it? I mean, money itself is something that could be used to pry people's consciousness into bigger realms, couldn't it?
Well, I mean, that's one perspective that I hear sometimes, that money is neutral. It depends on our attitudes toward it and how we use it.
Mm-hmm.
But it's actually not quite that simple. And one thing I go into in that book is how the process by which money is created has built into it scarcity, competition, endless growth, and the relentless drive to find something to convert into money. It has it kind of built in, but we could perhaps have a different kind of money system that would be built on a different story of the world, a different relationship, a different way of seeing things. But as it is today, it's not neutral.
And you call it, thank you for that, that makes sense, and you call it a gifting economy. The reason I found you is because I started looking up gifting economies on the internet,
mm-hmm.
and there you were in all your blazing glory with all your YouTubes. It's great. And your book, Sacred Economics, and the other one is that I've got here is More Beautiful World Than Our Hearts Know Is Possible, which really resonates with a lot of us, eh? Because there's abundance.
The More Beautiful World, yeah. The More Beautiful World Our Hearts Know Is Possible.
Yeah, and there's abundance all over the world. It's just we're not experiencing it, a lot of us, right?
Yeah. So as far as gifting economy goes, that label could be a little misleading. I guess I'm talking about two things. One is reclaiming some parts of our lives from the money economy.
Okay.
And because we've lost a lot, you know, things that our parents and grandparents and great-grandparents did for themselves or for the people they loved or mm-hmm. for the people in their community, we pay for now.
Mm-hmm.
Things like childcare, cooking. You know, most food today is prepared outside the home.
Yeah, or looking after older people.
Yep, looking after older people, entertainment.
Mm-hmm.
You know, my dad was telling me just the other day, again, he tends to repeat his stories, but how when he was a kid, Sunday afternoons, the whole neighborhood would get together and people would bring guitars and they would sing folk songs. So the production of entertainment and recreation, I mean, there were pickup baseball games and things all the time. That wasn't something that you paid for.
And when I was young, somebody had a piano and we all gathered
mm-hmm.
around and we brought guitars and ukuleles and anything
yeah.
else you had, right?
Right. So technology has aided in the conversion of social life into a service.
Right.
And the same thing has happened in the conversion of nature into products. So on one level, I'm talking about, you know, on a personal realm, how to reclaim life from money. And how to reclaim community that way. And then I'm also talking on the systems level how could money itself be redesigned, or how could the economic system be changed so that it's no longer the enemy of the sacred?
I like that. You know what hits me while you're talking about that? I remember hearing on NPR some years ago when the 2008 crash went on, and I think the Enron, I don't remember which exactly was the experience that was being talked about, but these fellows were being interviewed. They were on their way to jail, and they said, but it's so weird when you start printing as much money as you want. It's like you lose your mind. You lose yourself, you lose your connection. I think that's relevant to what you're saying, is people are swept into a trance and they're unaware of it, I think.
Yeah. But even like, I mean, that might be the super rich.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, I guess there's a kind of a delusion that if only I had enough money, my problems would be solved.
That's true. Yeah. I know a lot of people who think like that.
Yeah. And in a way, it is true. When everything is monetized, then of course, to meet your needs, you need money. But another way would be to demonetize and to meet needs in ways that money can't meet or doesn't meet. And there's certainly
I think when, like, you mean like caring?
Well, like people can cook for themselves again, learn these skills that have been lost, and in particular, get together and do things for each other instead of paying for them. Like, they can start time banks, they can start tool libraries, they can start community gardens, childcare co-ops, things like that, that kind of, demonetize life. And instead of relying on strangers who you're paying, you're relying on people that you know. So you develop connections and you develop community.
Well, that makes sense, doesn't it?
Yeah.
So, well, keep talking, because a lot of this...
Veronica, I'm curious, what brought you to look up gifting economy on the internet?
Because I feel deep in my heart that what you're calling the monetizing of our society is wrong, that we're always worrying. I do healing work, and you wrote a whole section on healers, and I love doing my work, but I feel this really odd guilt because I'm not paying enough attention to becoming more lucrative at, that sort of thing, because
right.
There's a kind of a judgment and an identity judgment, about who you are and what you're doing, whether you're making any money, or are you just a wastrel, or are you an old 60s radical, you know what I'm saying? It's like,
yeah.
And I keep thinking it's not right. We should be helping each other. We should be gifting each other. We should be giving. So I just came at it like that.
Yeah, and it goes both ways, because then there's another voice that says, so suppose you do start charging money. Then there's another voice that says you're a sellout, you're supposed to be giving it, you shouldn't be taking money for it.
Yeah.
And that goes side by side with the voice that says you should charge money for it, otherwise you're not doing it for real. You're just a dilettante, you're just, like you said.
You're a dreamer. Yeah.
A dreamer, yeah.
Yeah.
So we just have all of this programming. And
but there's another thing that bothers me too, which is people who are inventors, for example, get shoved out and even killed if they interrupt the marketplace. And that really hurts my feelings that it's so prevalent and it's gone on for so long. And that's a part of that whole sting too, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, our whole society is just kind of run through and through, governed on every level by the institutions of money and the habits of money, the perceptions of money. We're just really, we've grown up in that ocean, where money's everywhere and governs everything. And our own perceptions are clouded by that as well. And it takes, I think it's a long journey to deprogram from those habits.
Yeah, I'd like you to talk to us about that. That's really important. Do you actually see the possibility of us moving out of the conscription of the moneyed system? Do you see a possibility of us being able to do that?
Well, I mean, right now there's a lot of people like yourself who are, the way I see it is that people like you see your work as sacred. and you're like, you know, I just want to give this to as many people as will receive it. I don't want to set up a barrier that says, well, I'm only going to give it to you if you pay me. You know, there's that generous impulse.
Right. Because you know, we're powerful. We're very, very powerful people, but we just don't know how to tap our own power. That's where I go with it.
Mm-hmm. So I don't have like any easy answers for how.
Darn,
to,
we wanted you to,
yeah.
Charles.
I mean, because like, you know, like sometimes people say, oh, I'm just not going to charge, you know? And then a couple things often happen. One is that, you know, you don't make any money,
yeah.
Obviously,
right?
And the second thing, though, even worse maybe, is that the people coming to you for healing don't take it very seriously.
Right. They don't trust you. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You know, like they'll have like this nagging feeling like maybe you're not good enough to charge. You know, you're kind of a second-rate healer.
Right.
And so I'm going to try it out and see. But there's no psychological commitment. Whereas if they're paying, you know, $1,000 for somebody, then they're going to be taking it really seriously. That payment sends their unconscious mind a signal that I'm doing this for real. I'm committed to this.
Yeah, I agree
payment,
with that.
Mm-hmm. It's a ritual, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It really is a ritual. It's the manipulation of symbols in the hopes of affecting reality.
But it is a gifting in a way. I give you, you give me, right?
It can be done in that spirit.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and that's the way that I've been working as much as possible. You know, that I allow, if I'm giving a talk or a retreat or something, and it depends, if I'm doing it at an institution, it's a lot harder. And I'm not like a purist about it, but the way I like to do things is to allow the attendees to decide what the right price is. Sometimes there might be a deposit or something that they pay. And there's definitely a signal. It's not free. You know, that's not the concept that I'm using. It is, you know, maybe by donation or maybe you choose the price. That's a phrase I like to use.
Mm-hmm. I was reading a section where you were saying that, and I was kind of relieved when you said if someone isn't grateful and doesn't really want to pay, you just really don't bother putting your gift toward them anymore. Like,
yeah,
you judge yourself, or you select. Select is a good way to put it, I think. Okay.
Yeah, right. Because you don't want to give your gift to somebody who doesn't really want it or need it.
Mm-hmm. Or scorns it, really.
Or scorns it, right.
So back to you. So what happened in your life to put you on this path? Because I know at one point you were in the mode of making a pretty good income and in the system. And you were, doing translations in Taiwan or somewhere?
Yeah. I mean, that was a long time ago. In my 20s, I was a translator in Taiwan. And, mm-hmm. you know, yeah, I was doing all right. I was a freelancer. I wasn't really part of any institution, but I was making money, but I didn't care about what I was doing. I was only doing it to make money.
Okay.
And that over time became intolerable. And I, you know, as I got into my later 20s, I began thinking, well, why am I here?
Hmm.
Am I here just to survive? Am I here to do work that I'm paid to do, but that I don't really care about? Like, what about living my life? What about doing work that I care about for real? Do I ever get to do that?
Did you know at that point in your late 20s what you would be caring about?
Not really.
Mm.
No, I didn't know. I just knew it wasn't this.
Wow. Okay.
And that feeling, you know, so I raised my prices, you know,
good.
Hoping that it would go away. But instead I got even more business. So eventually no amount of money was enough to keep me doing it. And I took the plunge into the unknown. I moved back to the United States with no prospects whatsoever, no job, nothing, you know, just stepping into the unknown.
Was your family there? Were they pleased, or did you have any family report?
I mean, it was at that time, it was me and my wife and our 2-year-old and another one on the way.
Oh my. Okay.
Yeah. So
that's a challenge.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, we really had no plan. You know, we had maybe, I think we had $17,000 in savings.
And your wife was in agreement, though?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I don't think, I'm not sure if I said, okay, I'm quitting my job. I kept doing a little bit of freelance from the States, you know, via email and stuff, mm-hmm. for a little while after, for maybe half a year after, but it was impossible to do it. You know, I had put myself in a situation where I could no longer continue doing what I had been doing. And it just, yeah, I mean, that launched me into the unknown, you know, into the, I call it the space between stories.
Hmm. So you had to have a lot of courage too, hey? Or were you just so frustrated you didn't even need courage? You just needed to get across the bridge there.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not even sure what courage is. If it's...
I like hearing that it's from the heart. Courage is from the heart.
I guess that's what the word means.
Yeah, I like that, don't you?
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, I don't think that you know, I did anything heroic. I guess it was more of like taking the next right step.
Okay.
You know, because a lot of people are in that situation where they're doing something that isn't them. You know, this isn't me. This job isn't me. This is not where I'm meant to be. But I'm afraid. I'm afraid to quit because, you know, what if I lose my benefits? What if this? What if that? There's always a lot of reasons.
Yeah, I think most of the people I work with have some of that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, really, very few people love their work, mm-hmm. in this economy. Mm-hmm. And that's, I guess that also kind of circles back to sacred economics. Why is that? You know, why have we created a world with so much unpleasant work, mm-hmm. when the promise of technology and the Industrial Revolution was to eliminate tedious labor? But we work harder than hunter-gatherers worked. You know, we spend more time at work than hunter-gatherers do.
Well, we totally lost rapport with the cycles, haven't we? The actual, yeah. cycles of humanity or of life.
So, yeah, I mean, it's like this whole ball of yarn, you know, you pull at any of its threads and the whole thing unravels. And you start asking these basic questions. You know, why after 200 years or more of the Industrial Revolution with its constant invention of labor-saving devices, why do we not have a leisure society? Mm-hmm. And the reason is that we've always chosen to consume more rather than to work less. So anyway, yeah, so back to the you know, people not feeling that they love their work. And this goes not only for people doing menial jobs and doing them just to survive, but often, you know, for, you know, executives and
lawyers,
people who
even,
have,
yeah.
Lawyers, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's maybe 1 out of 5 or 1 out of 10 that could honestly say, I love my job. Mm-hmm. And I would do it even if money were not a factor. So that's a kind of slavery. If you're doing it because you have to, because of some threat, then you're not really free.
I agree.
So to escape does, yeah, I guess it requires some kind of courage. But for me and for a lot of people, I think it comes when you just can't stand it anymore. And then, yeah, you just can't stand it anymore. And it's something that had been really scary and would have required courage, it's just almost unstoppable.
Yeah, I think yeah. so. So you mentioned also, you at some point in one of the books, you were talking about the Gen X thing, that you're a Gen X person, and I'm kind of the mm-hmm. 60s radical person, you know, time-wise. I'm just talking about the
yeah.
vintage. Do you think, and I was really curious about this as I was reading, do you think that these flows of consciousness move through our species and that there's a wake-up going on, a wake-up into self-empowerment through, for example, your sacred economics approach, that kind of thing? Do you think it's penetrating a lot of people at this time?
I do think that more and more people are waking up from the narratives that have held us for a long time. And I think the 60s were kind of a preview of what's happening today. You know, a cynic could say, yeah, you know, we went through this in the 60s and then everybody went back to their slumber. And what's different today? I think one thing that's different is that we have your shoulders to stand on.
Well, you know, here's another thing I want to just throw in. I came out of the 60s and did that like, heck, we didn't win. But a lot of people I know, including myself, went inside to figure out what was really going on in me so that if I came back out, I had something to contribute, something to offer. And there's a lot of people in my vintage that have thought that as well.
Yeah.
So I'm just thinking we might be joining you people. We'll follow you. That's what we'll do.
I mean, yeah, there's kind of like this kind of embittered leftist critique of that whole process that says that your generation abandoned social change and abandoned the effort to make the world a better place and escaped into the inner realms of spirit, you know, this kind of, as kind of a bourgeois indulgence.
Yeah.
Well, on the one hand, you're, you know, drinking your cappuccinos from coffee plantations and participating in the ongoing destruction of the planet. But, you know, then you come home and on Saturday morning you go to yoga, you know, and it just kind of enables your participation in the destruction of the planet. And that's a critique that I don't actually buy. I don't really buy into it, but it is something that's present, and I think it needs to be faced.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know. I think that probably we don't need to get into this whole conversation, but it to me is a delightful conversation. And I think there's as many ways of going through from the 60s into the future as there are people, really. You know, I don't think it's all one way or the other, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think, like a lot of us, did pull away. And I'm really glad because some of the older people I'm meeting these days are really self-aware and they're just moving it, you know.
Uh-huh.
So that time was important for some.
Mm-hmm. So, Veronica, tell me about this program that we're...
Oh, this is called Paradigm Shifters. It's on BBS Radio. And what I do is I like to interview people that are pushing the envelope, making a difference and waking people up from the various, what I call is kind of like enslavement.
Mm-hmm.
We're enslaved by a system where we just run, you know, through it and don't really think about it.
Yeah.
And a lot of people like you are really shaking up that membrane that can kind of keep us in the trance. Does that make sense?
Yeah. I mean, you know, I've spent a long time, especially, you know, after I got back from Taiwan, you know, and went into this in-between zone, I was really pursuing the question of what's wrong around here.
Mm.
In a way, I've been pursuing it my whole life.
Mm-hmm.
But
it's innate in you, is it?
Yeah. You know, like, I mean, as a teenager, walking around thinking, this can't be right. The world isn't supposed to be this way.
Mm-hmm.
What I'm offered as normal isn't good enough. It's supposed to be more beautiful. It's supposed to be more authentic. You know, it's supposed to be more joyful. I'm not supposed to hate Monday because I have school all week and look forward to the weekend and someday feel the same about my job. And we're not supposed to be, you know, parking lots aren't supposed to be proliferating everywhere. And I read various radical books, you know, as a teenager that confirmed that feeling. And so I wanted to know the origin of the wrongness. What's the root cause? And I kind of investigated various candidates. Yeah, maybe it's, you know, capitalism. You know, maybe it's human greed, you know, some bad thing in us. Maybe it's just nature, the way things are. And I examined these various candidates over the years and, you know, kind of got into one and another of them. And eventually I realized that the source of the wrongness goes all the way to the bottom. It goes to our fundamental perception of ourselves and the world. And I would call it a story, the story that who we are is our separate individuals in an external world, this objective, reality of force and mass that's outside of ourselves,
mm-hmm.
that is indifferent to our well-being, and that doesn't possess the qualities of a self, doesn't have intelligence or purpose or you know, any of these subjective qualities. You know, we're kind of alone in a dead, purposeless universe. Like that perception I saw, so separate from nature, separate from each other, I saw that as the origin of everything that's happening today, treating nature as an other, treating other people as others, treating even separation from ourselves, you know, trying to conquer nature, conquer the self, transcend materiality, all of these things part of the same worldview that denies life, really.
Mm-hmm.
And that's so, like, so, you know, economics, money, well, the money system makes us separate from each other, mm-hmm. casts us into competition, mm-hmm. makes the world seem as if there's lots of competing others out there whose well-being is not connected to your well-being. You know, your neighbor gets the job, you don't get the job. You know, somebody else gets the high grade on the test and you get a low grade because you're competing on a curve. You know, and our whole economic system is kind of built like that because it's founded on interest-bearing debt, which means that when money is lent into existence, there's always more debt than there is money. So we're always
That's a really interesting concept. It's kind of depressing, but it's real, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. It's just, so on one level you could say, well, you know, we can just tweak the system and fix money and create it by some other means. And yeah, but the way that money works reflects deeper stories, deeper experiences of being that I think are more fundamental. And so I guess one way that I see my work and the work of many, many, many other people, I mean, in a way, we're all kind of servants of the same work.
Mm-hmm.
It's to change that story,
mm-hmm.
away from separate selves in a world of other into interbeings who are fundamentally not separate from each other in the world, and that, you know, therefore, whatever we do to the world, we do to ourselves, whatever's happening anywhere is happening to us, realizing that every relationship mirrors something within, and everything that's happening within will also happen in the world. Like this, because you know, you can just see like how much of not just our economic system, but, you know, American foreign policy or the prison system, these kind of things also reflect separation. Conquering the bad guy would be, mm-hmm. one of them, you know, conquering evil.
Mm-hmm.
That's the template. To make the world better, you identify evil and you conquer it by force. That's what the old story tells us to do.
Mm-hmm.
That's what most action movies tell us to do.
Mm-hmm.
That's how America seems to see the world. You know, okay, who's the bad guy? Who can we bomb? You know, who's the bad guy? Who can we lock up in prison?
But often they bomb not the bad guy, but something that's blocking their new resources or something.
Yeah, I
mean,
it's, you know, but that mindset has to find somebody to categorize as bad.
I know, that's interesting. That's really interesting, actually.
And so as long as that fundamental mindset doesn't change,
mm-hmm.
you're going to be hunting for the bad guy.
Mm-hmm.
And after the Soviet Union collapsed, then you know, it was the drug lords. Remember that? The
mm-hmm.
Colombian
drug
lords. They were the bad guy, you know, and they weren't quite scary enough. And we didn't know what to do, but then finally terrorism came along. You know, and we got plenty of bad guys to continue this narrative that is part of the world-destroying machine. And so I think what's happening today, and maybe we caught a glimpse of it in the 60s and throughout history, I mean, it keeps coming up, but what's happening maybe is an awakening from that story into the story of interbeing, into the story of ecology, into the story of reunion.
And even the internet brings some of that home to us, even though there's some negative sides to it, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think the internet is, it's on the one hand, it's the extreme of separation.
Mm-hmm.
Because
it isolates us, you mean, when we're on it? Is that what you mean?
Yeah, and puts us in this virtual world.
Right.
You know, where we're not even interacting with materiality. Everything's a pixel.
Right. Yes.
Yeah. But on the other hand, it is connecting us. It you know, some of these principles of interbeing, such as what you do in one place, you're doing in every place. You know, things kind of spread in the internet, and things are harder to keep hidden.
That's for sure. That's a good thing, isn't it?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah. So it sounds like you're saying that there's a waking up going on, would you say?
Yeah, that's one way to look at it, because that story of separation is getting old.
Mm-hmm.
It's not working anymore, and it's generating all kinds of crises.
And the financial problems that it brings up are getting, the world's too small for it, would you say?
Yeah, I mean, that's one dimension of the crisis, the financial crisis, which is really a crisis of growth.
So talk about that. Mm-hmm.
Our financial system only works in the presence of economic growth. And economic growth means the conversion of nature into product and the conversion of relationships into services. And we're running out of things to convert.
Mm.
You know, I live in a neighborhood where nobody knows each other and nobody depends on each other for anything.
Mm.
Everything's already been converted into a paid service. And the ecological crisis is telling us that we can't keep converting nature into product either.
You also mentioned, I think in your books and some of your YouTubes, that you thought those who had the highest like amount of money or the people that are really in power at certain levels are also experiencing how it's not going to continue working. Is that right? Have I said that right?
Yeah, I mean, I get that sense sometimes. Maybe I'm not talking to all the right people, but I get the sense that the elites no longer believe in the system either.
Yeah. Well, that's probably a good thing, hey, for all of us.
Yeah.
I guess I get really concerned, like when you're talking about the separation of people, I feel... this is kind of more simple, but they've wrecked, the food has been wrecked. American food is a dangerous thing, right?
Yeah, someone was just telling me that wheat before, like this was an internet thing recently, like apparently before they harvest it, they douse the whole field with Roundup.
Wow.
To put the wheat under a little stress so that it makes one more burst of seed-making effort.
Wow. No wonder so many people have wheat allergies now and, you know, are going off.
Yeah.
It's incredible.
Because you're taking in toxic chemicals along with your wheat.
But it doesn't make sense, does it? So you poison the food and you poison the water. What does it mean? What do we do? You know?
Well, you know, part of the story that I've been talking about of separation says that, we can escape the effects of what we do. We can engineer a solution to whatever consequence that we've created. Even if we, you know, destroy the soil, well, you know, we can have hydroponics, you know, we can have synthetic food. We can grow protein in vats. You know, there's this idea that we don't really need nature because we can always find an artificial substitute for it. And this is part of the mindset of separation. We're separate from nature. What happens out there need not affect us if we build a high enough wall, a big enough security fence, because we're separate.
Or if we move off to the moon or Mars or somewhere else.
Yeah,
out there.
Mm-hmm. Right. Leave nature behind altogether.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So what are the solutions? Are you finding people getting community conscious more and more? What's happening out there?
Well, I mean, almost anything that we call alternative or holistic is coming from a new story.
Okay.
So something like biodynamic agriculture or permaculture kind of, you know, it doesn't see the land just as a source of materials, but it sees it as a living being.
Mm-hmm.
And the farmer communicates with the land and co-creates with the land and seeks to understand the intelligence of that land. So it's a very different kind of relationship than technology manipulating building blocks and imposing its image onto external reality. The kind of healing, I don't know, actually, what kind of healing do you do?
Energy healing. I'm also a psychic and intuitive.
Okay, so. So the kind of work you're doing comes from that same story mm-hmm. of interbeing that says that there is an intelligence outside of ourselves, mm-hmm. that the order in this world isn't merely confined to what we impose upon it, but that there, but we are part of a larger intelligence that sometimes we can read, sometimes we can communicate, we can sense that, and this intelligence resides in the body mm-hmm. and in the events of our lives, and we can come into a relationship with that. So that's why the work that you do is linked to the work that a permaculture farmer is doing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I'm sure you've felt that feeling of alliance.
Oh,
with
for
such
sure.
People.
Mm-hmm. Oh,
but
yeah.
What is that alliance about? Like, why do you feel that?
Even with your work, Charles.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it's because we all serve the same story. That's why we know that we are allies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's wonderful, actually. Yeah. So keep talking, because how does a person awaken? What you're implying when I'm reading this material, which is so wonderfully rich, is that the awakening can come up in some of the least likely places. Even mm-hmm. like when you talk about the elite maybe being insecure about their, you know, their kingdoms, if you will, is there a waking up
yeah.
going on in that? Is that how we're going to make the
difference?
Well,
I think it's happening everywhere. And I think that sometimes when people hear this kind of material, they're like, okay, well, how can I wake up?
Yeah, exactly.
You know, what can I do to wake up more? And I think that is actually the wrong question.
Okay.
Because it's not something that we achieve through our own efforts, I think. I mean, maybe there are parts of the process where we make a mighty effort and achieve something, but many, many parts of this process are not things that we accomplish. It's not something we accomplish. It's something that's happening to us. So perhaps merely reading a certain book or hearing this information implants something inside of us that works us.
I liked your story about the seniors' residence in Oregon. Do you want to talk? Do you remember that story where you were talking about how
yeah.
poor people? Would you like to talk about that? I like that.
I could. It's a change of topic from what I was just talking about. But
I thought you were talking about coming at. Okay, go ahead. We'll go back to that.
Yeah, I'll circle to it somehow. So I guess letting go of life being filled with these things that you have to do.
Okay.
And do right. That's important because a lot of our doing is conditioned by the habits of separation.
Right.
So sometimes we need to just stop. And in those moments of stopping, then we can sense we're aware of things that we were not aware of before. We're aware of different ways of doing things that are not necessarily fighting something or imposing something by force. So the story you were referring to, I met this guy he's the last person you'd expect to be waking up. He runs this company that manages, nursing homes, like elder care facilities of different kinds for low-income people. So depending on government subsidies and insurance payments and all kinds of, I mean, just a tremendous bureaucratic mess, subject to the pressures of the real estate market and the residents and their families and the government and, you know, just an impossible business. He told me that his competitors, in the week before I visited him, two of his competitors called begging that he buy them out.
Oh, really?
Just because it was an impossible business, you know. And he says, every day I go to my office and there is a pile of impossible problems on my desk. and I don't know how to solve them. And I bow into service.
I bow into service? Is that what
Yeah,
he said? Oh my.
That was the phrase he used.
That's wonderful.
I bow into service. And then one miracle after another happens.
Wow. That's a wonderful story.
Yeah, and I like this idea of bowing into service as an alternative to always making an action plan.
Yeah, really.
Which isn't to say that there's never a time to make an action plan. But when you don't know how to achieve what you want to achieve, then something has to happen that's beyond your capacity. You know, you have to be in the right place at the right time. There has to be a synchronicity.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that being deeply in service generates those kinds of synchronicities and allows us to not to create more than we thought we were capable of, but allows us to be part of a creative process that creates a lot more than we could on our own.
That's really heartening, isn't it? So do you work
Yeah.
with that yourself?
I guess so. I mean, I try to.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess in some ways I do, and then I also discover ways in which I'm still, controlling things.
Yeah. I guess we all have to, that's part of the learning, isn't it? Is knowing when that's in your way or whatever.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, that's a really wonder. I love that story a lot. Bowing into service. That's really important, mm-hmm. isn't it? Coming from the heart, isn't it?
Maybe I'm,
just different.
Or maybe that's another thing, or maybe they're related. But, I mean, I think if you're working as a psychic, you're doing much the same thing. You know, it's not like you can infer logically the information that you get.
No, and sometimes it's very illogical sounding.
Yeah. You know, you're trusting something beyond yourself.
Mm-hmm. And it's humbling, actually.
Mm-hmm.
Even though you sometimes do some amazing things. So what do you think about the world? Let's go back into your worldview and the monetizing of everything, including yoga and yoga clothes. I mean, my goodness, it doesn't matter which level at which we approach it, right? Do you think it's too late? Do you think we can actually pull it off before the world gets too squished by our behavior?
I think things will get much worse before they get better.
Hmm.
But I think that this passage that humanity is going through was not set up to be impossible.
Okay.
It is set up to have moments where it looks impossible. And for many of us, we are at such a moment today.
Yeah, it's really intense at times, isn't it? So what do you recommend for people?
Depends on the person.
Yeah. I suppose that's true, eh? But like,
and I don't necessarily have am I supposed to be the guy with the recommendations, you know?
Yeah, you are. No, of course not. But I know you've done a tremendous amount of work and a tremendous amount of inspiring of people. So, and you mentioned community and that sort of thing. Is that what you're talking about to people? Is like looking at community, looking at the kind of communities that you could be involved in?
I mean, I'm not an expert on that. It's one of the themes that's kind of woven in.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, maybe some of the things I said, you know, strike a chord. I guess my more general advice is to listen to what strikes a chord, you know, listen to what makes you feel alive and follow that. And soon following what makes you feel alive will take you up to the boundaries of your courage. And there'll be something that you see on the other side that you really want, but you're not quite ready for it yet. And then you wait.
You wait for the inspiration?
You wait and something is happening to you that expands the boundaries of your courage.
Hmm.
And to trust that process and to say, when the moment comes, I'll know it and I'll choose it. It'll be clear.
And you have children, don't you?
Four children, yeah.
So I think a lot of us are, how do we raise children into this? I guess just by being that way, hey?
It's another thing I don't have the answers for, but I mean, I guess I have thought a lot about parenting and noticing many of the ways that we raise children embody the old paradigms of conquest and control.
Mm-hmm.
Just like a minor thing, you know, like I see people always telling their kids to say thank you, say excuse me, say please, say I'm sorry. And as if this kind of behavior has to be conditioned onto them through the force of an implicit threat, you know, like the approval or disapproval of the parent is a kind of force because it keys into the abandonment fear of any young mammal. And so, but when you say, you know, say sorry, say thank you, really what you're teaching is insincerity. Say it when you don't even feel it. But you can't be sincere. You can't trust your feelings because why? Well, part of the old story is that we're fundamentally bad and that goodness comes through conquest of nature, conquest of inner nature, conquest of the wild, you know, conquest of the unconditioned part of ourselves. So that might be one way that, you know, that I might be different as a parent. I mean, I never, ever tell my kids to say that they're sorry.
Are they naturally grateful? You spoke about babies being naturally grateful, which I thought was wonderful.
Well, I mean, you know, we all have a mix of different things. I think my children have turned out to be very courteous, despite my never telling them to be courteous, because they see the examples. And they're trusted. Like, I trust that who they really are, who they really want to be, is somebody who is courteous. So it's a big, you know, I mean, the habits of control, the habits of judgment, the habits of conquest, the habits of forcing, these are woven into every aspect of life.
Mm-hmm.
And the process of becoming aware of them goes through many stages and variations. And that's why I can't really, you know, offer much of a to-do list. But I can say that as this way of perceiving infiltrates your being, that much will change.
Yeah, because it occurs to me all the way through our conversation, it keeps occurring to me that the influence of our identities have often been forged by the influence of money on our lives, even at birth.
Right.
And that sometimes has mesmerized me in my life, like, wow, it doesn't necessarily make this person a better person, but he gets the points for it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? So what you're saying is back up and perceive and don't use those labels or the punitive statements, right?
Yeah, I mean, I could offer that as kind of a formula, but they have to be coming from a real perception.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I've seen, I don't know if you're aware of, you know, nonviolent communication and like there's many practices of you know, using I statements, and there's all kinds of, you know, practices around communication, but all of those can be used violently or used in the spirit of the old story. So, you know, I can't really offer a formula, but those kinds of technologies, you know, of nonviolent communication and things like that, they come a lot more naturally as we step in to the perceptions of interbeing, of oneness, you know.
Mm-hmm.
They become just more, they become second nature. They become obvious. You know, it's like the difference between preserving a rainforest because you think that it's going to produce lots of medicines for you in the future and generate more economic benefit preserved, or preserving it because you actually see it as a sacred being. You know, when you see it as a sacred being, then all of the behaviors that preserve it will come much more naturally.
I like that a lot. That's like bowing to service, isn't it? And slowing down and recognizing the wisdom in all living, in all life, right? I think this is just wonderful. And I just trust that there's an awakening going on all over the world on this level. And you're doing great work with it, I believe. Where are you going next to talk?
Actually, I'm leaving like real in a few minutes.
Oh, okay.
To go to New Jersey.
Okay. And you're going to give a talk there?
At Drew University, yes. A very romantic destination.
Oh, and all right. Well, I will say thank you very much for spending time with us. And you'd like to give people the name of your contact information?
I mean, the best hub would be charleseisenstein.net.
Okay. And you have a ton of YouTubes, which are very intriguing. And your books, you have another book, which I haven't read, which is called The Ascent of Mankind.
The Ascent of Humanity. Yeah. I wrote that, you know, about 10 years ago, I was really in the thick of writing that.
Well, we have almost a minute left. Can you just talk a tiny bit about that?
That's about the tide of separation and how it's generated all of the structures of our civilization and how it's in crisis and giving birth to reunion. So it just goes into all of the different systems that we have. It's a much bigger book. It's like 600 pages. Whereas the most accessible of my books is probably the most recent one, The More Beautiful World, et cetera, et cetera. I'll say the real title, The More Beautiful World Our Hearts Know Is Possible.
Well, I love it. And your work is just really wonderful. I'm so grateful that you're on the planet and doing what you're doing.
Thank you, Veronica. Very kind of you to say that.
Take care and hope we'll catch up with you again.
Yeah. Thank you for having me on.
All right. Take care.
Okay.
Bye.
Bye-bye.